From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, at a summit of Islamic nations in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad shocked his audience with a long screed condemning Muslims for self-defeating behavior and for being overmatched at every turn by the Jews, whom, he said, run the world by proxy. The speech was an attention-getter, prompting yelps of outrage and not a little sympathy from the press around the world. Joining us once again is Martin Walker, senior correspondent for United Press International. Martin, let's start with the reaction by the Arab and Muslim press. Shock, affirmation, what?
Well, what I was really struck by was that most of the Arab and Islamic press seemed to agree that Mahathir was speaking some blunt truths. But they also seemed to think that he'd made a great mistake to say it, that he was misunderstood, that the rest of his message was not taken seriously, and so on. So, for example, in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, which is one of the better London-based pan-Arab papers, Mohamad generalized and condemned Jews when he probably meant Israelis. And this is the kind of generalization we complain about when we, our Arabs, are described as terrorists, because only some of us refuse to refrain from killing thousands of civilians and hijacking planes. Al-Ahram of Egypt ran an editorial saying that the problem with Mahathir's statements is that they were ambiguous. The Malaysian Prime Minister didn't mean the Jews as people. What he wanted to show to Muslims was the way the Jews took to achieve these goals. They used the application of science and proper thinking rather than violence, terror, and speech-making. And that's the kind of comment that one sees an awful lot in the more thoughtful Arab press. They have picked up upon the bulk of Mahathir's speech, which is saying what was wrong with the Islamic world, rather than the part which appalled the West, quite rightly, when he said that the Jews rule the world by proxy. Only in a few places, like, for example, in the Star of Malaysia itself, do you find the kind of statement saying that Mahathir just spoke the plain truth. And why was there no attempt by the Western media to prove him wrong by showing the Jews aren't proxy rulers? Instead, the Western media just indulged in bashing, name-calling, and tagged him as anti-Semitic.
To prove the negative response. Now, let's move to the Western media, and especially to Europe, which has more than casual experience with the consequences of scapegoating Jews. What was the reaction in the German press and elsewhere?
The German press, the Italian press, the British press were all universally appalled. Die Welt of Germany said, "This is the age-old libel, the age-old evil. We have seen its face before and we know what it can achieve." What I thought was very interesting, however, was the bizarre reaction in France, because Chirac vetoed an attempt by the European Union summit to issue a declaration condemning Mahathir's statement. Chirac said that it simply wasn't the place of the European Union to do this. The context of this is that about 3 months ago, Jacques Chirac was in Malaysia receiving from the hands of Mahathir Mohamad the Kuala Lumpur World Peace Award for his service in trying to stop the Iraq War. What Chirac did was to write a personal letter to Mahathir Mohamad in which he condemned the remarks and said that they were wrong and badly chosen. But he also said that he noticed with interest and appreciation that Mahathir had condemned the suicide killings against the Israelis. As a result, Mahathir comes back and thanks Chirac for having understood. Merci bien, Monsieur le Président, parce que vous m'avez compris. Thank you for being the only person in the West who seems to understand what I was trying to do. As a result, the French press has been absolutely full of this particular controversy. Le Monde made the point that the relationship between our president and the outgoing, about-to-depart president of Malaysia is obviously a very special one, but that should not have allowed Jacques Chirac to stop Europe from expressing its own powerful antipathy to the anti-Semitic remarks made by Mahathir.
Well, on the subject of setting one belief system against another, there was another speech to make one gasp by a U.S. general before a prayer group. Tell me what the reaction has been around the world to that story.
Well, I think the reaction to General Boykin's remarks was simply redoubled because it came even hard on the heels of Mahathir's remarks. General Boykin became well known for the issuing of a video of him speaking to a church group in which he was talking about his time in Somalia and saying that the result was that the Christian army of God is much more powerful than Islam. He went on, "My God is bigger than your God," in relation to Islam. And it turns out that he's the senior official in the Counterterrorism Office of the Pentagon, which might be a bit of a problem. Anyway, the Arab world has picked up on this, in part, I think, because it gives them a chance to come back on the Mahathir issue. So, Dar al-Hayat. US General Boykin's racial obscenity towards Islam and Muslims has instigated a wave of solidarity with Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir. The solidarity has spread out amongst politicians, officials, writers and journalists throughout the Islamic world. The Gulf News in Dubai, which is normally a very pro-Western newspaper, General Boykin's remarks stand as glaring proof that the US-led war against terrorism is in reality a war against Islam as a whole. The speech by General Boykin highlights the West's double standard. Today's state of the world demands the practice of peace, friendship, brotherhood and tolerance, especially between the West and the Islamic world. So inciting and confrontational comments such as those given by General Boykin is a guarantee that extremism will survive and indeed flourish.
Well, the Bush administration was clearly rattled by that reaction because having seen how incensed the Muslim world was by General Boykin's comments, they said, well, he's doing a good job, so we'll just let him stay.
And indeed, as the Straits Times concluded, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad is a Boykin in reverse.
Well, Martin, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is senior correspondent for United Press International. In other incendiary anti-Semitism news, the world of American journalism and its blogging subculture were stunned a little more than a week ago when Greg Easterbrook, blogging on the New Republic magazine's internet site about Hollywood violence, invoked images of money-grubbing Jews. A few days later, Easterbrook apologized for mangling words in what he maintained was an otherwise defensible argument, but it was too late. At least too late to avoid getting fired from his gig on ESPN, and to prevent being forever linked with blogging irresponsibility in the absence of an editorial safety net. Joining me now to discuss the dangers of premature sendulation is Mickey Kaus, author of Kaus Files on Slate.com. Mickey, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you.
So about a week ago, Greg Easterbrook pressed the send button and thus commenced a nightmare. Tell me about the blogger's life and the meaning of that send button.
It means you're talking to the whole world. When we do that in print, there's usually an editor there to prevent us from saying anything really dumb, and when you blog, there's not.
So what mechanism do you as a blogger use to protect yourself and the world against the ill-considered thought, against the incorrect statement of fact, against the gross offense to an entire religion and culture?
There are two mechanisms. One is internal censorship, and number two is instant reader feedback and instant correction. And many bloggers feel that Greg's mistake was he didn't correct it quickly enough. I mean, that's the virtue of blogging over print and over talking on national television, is that you can change things very quickly. And if Greg had said, wait, that doesn't make sense, that's not what I meant to say, this whole thing never would have erupted. He took 3 or 4 days before he posted an apology, and that's, in blogging terms, that's a long time.
All right. Now, the wrinkle in all of this is that in Greg Easterbrook's case, he was not just a blogger, but he was a blogger whose blog appears on the New Republic website. It is, in effect, a column authorized and brought to you by the New Republic, and yet unedited by the editors at the New Republic. Is he a blogger or is he a columnist who needs an editor?
Well, he's sui generis. He is what he is. He is a blogger writing on the New Republic website. Obviously, the editors of the New Republic can't be responsible for everything he says the way they are responsible if they edit his column. So the responsibility logically flows from the actual process by which it's written. I don't think lawyers will be satisfied with that explanation. I think as far as legal liability for libel, for example, they would still hold the New Republic editors responsible. And I think once the lawyers get into this whole process, everybody will have an editor.
Well, putting aside for a moment legal liability, let's just talk about journalistic ethics. Is there not an ethical responsibility for a publication to take responsibility for that which it publishes, at a minimum by reading it in advance?
I don't see why. I mean, the New Republic took responsibility after the fact here, and they apologized. Why can't the New Republic say, look, Greg Easterbrook's a smart guy, we're going to let him blog on our site? They let him go on national television and talk representing the New Republic. publications do that all the time. People go on live TV and talk. Why shouldn't they have to be censored too? So I don't accept that.
Orville Schell, who is the dean of the journalism school at the University of California at Berkeley, said that, quote, an edited blog is a contradiction in terms. Is that right? Once you become part of the editorial apparatus of the hosting organization, do you cease to be a blogger and mutate into some other entity?
An edited blog is an edited blog. It doesn't have the same immediacy and spontaneity as an unedited blog. It could still be really good. It could still be much faster than a printed column where you have to wait for the presses to run and you can't change things after the fact. So I don't think it's in any way sort of an untenable form. It's a perfectly valid form, but my point is only that an unedited blog is a perfectly valid form too.
Tell me for a moment about the community of bloggers. You know, obviously we're asking these questions, but I'm sure the emails and the blog entries were flying back and forth fast and furious in the past week or two because of the Easterbrook incident. Is there a consensus building about what this has done to the landscape?
I haven't seen it. There hasn't been a lot of talk about, oh, this shows we have to change our ways. Bloggers are naturally supportive of each other, in part because it's a new medium and there's a lot of blogger triumphalism around about how the landscape of the First Amendment is changing and we're taking on the established powers, et cetera, in part because bloggers have an interest in being nice to each other because we send readers to each other. So the ecology of blogging is sort of back-scratching as opposed to hostile.
Since you mentioned these blogging universe's sense of mission and purpose and historical significance, it strikes me sometimes that it's almost messianic. And we get a lot of email from bloggers who, if Dan Rather did the CBS Evening News tonight in women's clothing and we reported on it this weekend, on Monday we'd get emails that said, sure, Dan Rather cross-dressed on the Evening News, but why didn't you do something about blogs? Has this deflated what seems to be a sometimes overblown sense of self-importance among those in the blogosphere?
It's helped deflate it. Blogger triumphalism sort of deflated by itself a bit. I mean, there are some bloggers like Virginia Postrel who've been campaigning against blogging hubris for months or even years. But I have not seen any great hand-wringing debate in the blogosphere. Maybe there's been too little, but I haven't seen a lot of it.
All right. Well, Mickey, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mickey Kaus is the author of Kaus Files, which you can find unedited and unbowed on Slate.com. Coming up, where advertising intrudes on programming and where it abandons it. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield, and here's a segment from Tampa, Florida, local morning TV.
Forget the Keys and the Caribbean. The Lee Island coast has all the island adventure you could want, but without all the travel. It's just a quick trip south of Sarasota.
Whatever you may think, that bit from WFLA's popular morning offering called Daytime is not a fluffy feature story. It's a fluffy ad, seamlessly placed among non-advertising features. This experimental hybrid has generated high ratings and, its producers say, zero viewer complaints. But Daytime's ethics were questioned by the Washington Post last week, putting the station and its owner, Media General, on the defensive. Eric Land is WFLA's president and general manager, and he joins me now. Eric, welcome to OTM.
Well, thanks, Bob.
Overall, would you characterize Daytime as a program or as an infomercial?
I think Daytime what we have to understand is that the format in and of itself was created as a vehicle to provide long-form advertising. So I would submit that the program, in its infancy, and we're still in its infancy, is more local content than advertorial. As we go forward, we hope that the sustaining part of the program will be more and more in the advertorial range.
So one day, not long ago, the viewers of WFLA-TV turned on Channel 8 in the morning, and there they saw a segment that sounded like this.
Cool cars on the big show today. Larry Wises joins us from the Ed Morse Auto Plaza. Good to see you, sir.
Good to be here.
Boy, I'm excited about today. We got an RX-8. and I don't want to talk about it first. I want to tease our viewers because it'll be their first time seeing it. But we also have a new one. They just call it the 6?
Mazda 6. You were talking earlier about places to go here in Florida. We've got the perfect cars for you to do that in.
Now, Eric, there is no delineation from segment to segment between what is pure editorial and what is there because a sponsor has paid to put it there. They all look approximately like segments on a morning chat show. Is that fair to the audience?
I think it is, because if it is not characterized as editorial, and it's not because it's entertainment in nature, and because the program is labeled at the end for those segments that are in fact advertiser supported, we feel we've met an ethical standard. I would liken the program more to Regis and Kelly, for example, than I would to any of the news products that we have on Channel 8 in Tampa.
Okay. My question isn't about whether the viewer is being somehow tricked into thinking that he or she is watching news and, in fact, is watching advertising. My question is whether the viewer is being tricked into thinking he or she is watching entertainment programming and is watching advertising.
I think, unfortunately, you're trying to apply journalistic values to entertainment programming, and the two don't compare.
What's your favorite entertainment show, cop show or whatever?
My favorite cop show is on NBC, and it's Law & Order.
Okay, so imagine yourself watching Law & Order. And in the midst of the plot one day, a car pulls up. And one of the characters admires the car and says, "What are you driving? Nice ride." And the guy says, "Well, I'm glad you asked that question. This happens to be a brand new Toyota Avalon with 212 horsepower and the quietest ride in its category." And the other character says, Toyota Avalon. And then they continue with whatever the jurisprudence story is of the day. Now, you're a viewer. You're going to be ticked off.
I would be outraged, because when I tuned in, I would have expected an entertainment program in prime time. That's not what daytime is. When viewers tune into daytime, they know exactly what they're getting. It's an entertainment program with advertorial segments. Very clear.
Eric, it's a one-second type-only crawl during the credits segment. Are you suggesting that people are hanging on every word of the crawl during the credits sequence that rolls
by? No, I don't think that at all, Bob. But what I think is happening here is that you're trying to enlist me in an argument over your opinion of how the station needs to label itself.
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm picking a fight with you on whether the viewers understand what they're seeing and whether there is ample enough disclosure of it.
And our opinion has been to this point that we feel it has been amply labeled. We feel the viewers recognize the difference between the program's content and its paid-for content. Does that mean that we will not revisit it going forward like we do all of our other policies? Absolutely we will. To do otherwise would be arrogant. But the bottom line is, we've got a number one program, more often than not, in its time period, that has met its goal, and I think our viewers and advertisers stood the test of time, at least for the first 2 years.
Well, Eric, thank you very much. You're kind to join us.
Thank you, Bob.
Eric Land is president and general manager of WFLA-TV in Tampa, Florida. Well, that's morning chat. At least viewers can rest assured that stories they see on the local news are journalistically pure. Or can they? The convergence of public relations ingenuity and broadcast stations' budgetary exigencies has yielded another dubious hybrid, the video news release, a PR bonanza and the news business's dirty little secret. Here's an example.
Sure, it's packed with vitamin C, but orange juice has plenty more to offer. It can help protect your heart by raising your good cholesterol. And when it's fortified, it's a great source of calcium for non-milk drinkers. And that's not all.
It's also rich in potassium, which reduces our risk for high blood pressure and for stroke.
That was a story about the health miracle of orange juice on WWLP-TV, Springfield, Massachusetts. But it wasn't a story discovered, written, and produced by WWLP. It was a VNR, a video news release, prepared by the Ketchum PR agency on behalf of its client, in this case, PepsiCo's Tropicana. Each year, thousands of such VNRs are distributed by corporations, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, and even members of Congress who have discovered it's easier to manage the news when you actually produce it yourself. Thus, the ever-growing deluge of expensively produced news-like video reports, crafted often by ex-journalists, to look and sound like actual telejournalism.
It is not news. It is fake news.
John Stauber is executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and author of Toxic Sludge is Good for You, a scathing lefty broadside against the public relations industry. He believes the use of VNRs amounts to systematic deception of viewers, both by the hidden interested parties behind them and by news organizations with impure motives themselves.
So if I'm a TV news director and I can fill most of the so-called 7 or 8 minute news hole on a local TV news program with provided footage that I get for free, I can save tens of thousands of dollars or more.
News directors don't like to talk about VNRs. The few who returned our calls said they seldom use the free material. But according to Nielsen Media Research, by 1994, 100% of TV stations were using them, and 80% were doing so at least several times a month. And today's digital watermarking of the footage proves nothing has changed. Larry Moskowitz is the founder and president of MediaLink, one of the world's largest producers and distributors of VNRs.
We've determined prima facie and scientifically and electronically that every television station in America with a newscast has used and probably uses regularly this material from corporations and organizations that we provide as VNRs or B-roll or other terminology we may use.
Not all VNRs run whole. Most often they are mined for a clip of background footage here, an interview fragment there. But producers estimate that as many as 1 in 3 appear uncut, unedited, and unexamined for balance or even basic accuracy. And why? Because they are there, tempting budget-battered news directors, and because they are free.
VNRs are enabling devices.
Former CBS correspondent Deborah Potter is director of the News Lab, the Washington, D.C. nonprofit dedicated to quality local television.
They allow newsrooms to do less of their own work without fear of running out of material before the end of the hour. It's a concern, and it ought to be a concern, frankly, for viewers if much of the material that they're starting to get on the news isn't news.
As long as there has been a press, there has been a symbiotic relationship between journalism and PR, and not necessarily an insidious one. Publicists and politicians looking to promote their agendas can serve those interests and the media's as well by calling attention to news or even fluff of interest to the public. It then becomes the media's job to establish the broader context and to separate the newsworthy wheat from the gratuitously promotional chaff, and to be clear about the source of PR-furnished material. For instance, the Tropicana excerpt you heard at the top of this piece we found in a documentary based on John Stauber's book, Deborah Potter.
I feel very strongly that if stations are going to use VNR material, they need to tell where it came from. It makes a difference if the whaling video you're using came from Greenpeace or from the Coalition to Support Whaling.
Barbara Cochran, president of the Radio and Television News Directors Association, says she believes most stations and networks do routinely identify the source of outside video, as per the ethical guidelines of her organization. But those within the VNR industry roll their eyes at that assertion. Doug Simon of VNR producer D.S. Simon Productions says disclosure is the exception, not the rule.
From what we see, there's a very small percentage, perhaps less than 5%, that actually is identified what the source of the video is.
That makes him uneasy, but VNR producers can't do such disclosure themselves. Each station uses a different on-screen typeface to identify video, so the onus is on those airing the material. And dependent as they are on the illusion of a far-flung news-gathering operation with tentacles throughout the community and beyond, there's little motivation to do so.
Can I say that local television stations have been lax? Yeah.
MediaLink's Moskowitz acknowledges that stations are less than scrupulous about identifying the source of the footage he supplies. He does not believe, however, that the sin is particularly grave, at least compared to other forms of journalism.
There is more unexpurgated, unedited, and unredacted press information that shows up in the average daily newspaper in America, and certainly in the average weekly newspaper, probably by a 5-to-1 factor over the PR material that shows up in television. So you might be going after the wrong goat here.
The two wrongs make a right argument isn't the only one in favor of the video news release. Candace White, marketing professor at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville and co-author of a 2001 study about VNRs, says the same self-interest that encourages news directors to use VNRs dictates that the material is used responsibly.
See, I trust news producers to be able to weed out true news value. I give them credit for being able to recognize blatant sales pitches. Our study found that the corporate videos were used the least, and the ones about health and safety were used the most.
But it's not necessarily the blatant sales pitches that are so dangerous. It is the subtle sales pitches, and the implication of independent journalistic approval conferred on a company or organization and its point of view, which is why her study's co-author, journalism professor Mark Harmon, sees VNRs as, quote, insidious devices by corporate America to control the American agenda. Nor is the problem restricted to the local news. Not only do major networks use VNR footage, at least one, CBS, has a division which produces and distributes them. This gets back to the disdain and fear voiced by author and consumer advocate John Stauber.
All public relations is not sinister or evil or bad. But I think the important thing to understand is that, indeed, all public relations is propaganda.
So whether it's images of a NASA spacewalk or a self-congratulatory soundbite from your congressman or swell health news about delicious calcium-fortified Tropicana orange juice, the message for TV news consumption is as ever. Let the viewer beware. While TV runs into problems when it fails to separate advertising from programming, it certainly can't do without advertising altogether. And sponsors aren't picking up the programming tab out of the goodness of their hearts. They need an audience to watch the commercials. And the steady shrinking of network audiences is creating a gathering terror. The latest shocker from the A.C. Nielsen Company, a report that since last season alone, 750,000 men aged 18 to 34, advertisers' most coveted demographic, has simply stopped watching TV. Joining me now to discuss this bombshell is David Poltrack, Executive Vice President of Research and Planning at CBS. Dave, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, 750,000 human souls vanishing, just disappearing. What's going on?
Well, I wish I had the answer to that question. This is one of these anomalies that turns up in the audience measurement system occasionally and would just be sort of an idle curiosity if it didn't mean so much economically.
Fine, it may be an anomaly, or it may just be some sort of blip that will be self-correcting. But what if it isn't? Is it possible that this is, as someone put it, the canary in the mine shaft?
Advertisers are not going to abandon network television to any significant degree unless they can find something better. And the fragmentation in the television marketplace has impacted the television network audiences significantly, but it hasn't really created any new alternative. The fact that the networks have maintained their pricing is really a function of the fact that the top 20 shows have had significantly less erosion than the balance of the shows. So the premium product of network television has relatively held up. And in this particular case, of course, it's not just the network audience that's going down, it's the overall audience that's going down. So there will be no relative winner in this if it continues, which means that there's not an alternative out there that's getting stronger as a result of this. So it'll probably have very little effect in terms of the supply and demand mechanics of the marketplace.
I want to ask you for a moment to at least consider taking off the rose-colored glasses. Recently, you were quoted responding to a projection that the use of personal video recording devices like TiVo was going to quintuple by the year 2007. Which will in effect dramatically reduce the number of people actually watching commercials broadcast on over-the-air television. You were quoted as kind of shrugging, saying, well, you know, we lose a certain percentage of our audience every year to cable, and the model continues to be going strong. Is it possible that between the growth of the internet, between the introduction of such devices as TiVo and other PVR technology,
and the overall fragmentation of the audience, that networks are close to losing the critical mass of gigantic audiences that enable them to sustain this model, and that there's a death watch on for the goose that lays the golden egg. Is that one of the possibilities?
Well, these are all changes that we have to adapt to. We recognize that we can't count on just our distribution system to keep us on top. And we have to look at cross-platform types of arrangements, repurposing, all of the different things that are going to be very much a function of an environment where the viewer has more control. We have a challenge ahead of us. There's no question about it. I mean, that's why we're pushing so hard for the FCC relaxation on the ownership limits, because the economics of local television station ownership support the finances and the programming investments of the television networks. The more stations we own, the more stable the advertiser model is for us. And there are a lot of pressures on that model. There's no question about it. We're not being complacent or blasé about the fact that it's just going to continue to go on.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Okay.
David Poltrak is Executive Vice President of Research and Planning at CBS. He joined us from his office at BlackRock. Coming up, a documentation of terror using the terrorists' own video. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, readers of the New York Times, without warning, were deprived of their news gothic. That's a sans-serif headline type, which, along with five other fonts, was dropped by Times editors in favor of the more familiar serifed Cheltenham typeface that already dominates the headlines. The craftsman behind the facelift was Matthew Carter, perhaps the foremost type designer alive. Among his credits are Time Magazine, Sports Illustrated, The Washington Post, and The Phone Book, not to mention authorship of many typefaces themselves. He joins me now from his home office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Matthew, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Why does a newspaper in general see the necessity to change typographically what it's been doing, sometimes for decades?
There can be a number of reasons. Other newspapers I've worked for have gone over to different technologies, and that has given them an opportunity to sort of revisit the typography of the paper and make some changes. Sometimes it happens for no other reason than that they're bored with the way they were. You know, it's been that way for a long time and they want to change it. It's often tied into some editorial changes. They will add sections or change sections or start moving things around within the paper. So it's part of the reorganization of a newspaper from the editorial point of view.
Now, I have to say, it's only been a few days. I'm getting used to it. However, I'm not sure that's a consensus. There was a letter in Thursday's paper that read as follows: "You have made Bland the quirky persona that made the Times special and given us the typeface equivalent of New Coke. It's the end of the world as we know it." In general, do readers react to changes, subtle or extreme, in the way newspapers are presented to them?
Readers do react. The pros and the cons almost always exactly balance out. You get the same number of people who say, you know, at last I can read the paper without my glasses, and people who say, I'm off to the optician because I can no longer read your newspaper.
So from a business point of view, you're really in an enviable position, because at the moment the New York Times wants uniformity. They want a whole family of Cheltenhams. But
yes.
I think you can be pretty confident that sometime in the next 10 years or so, they're going to be right back to you saying, you know, we're fed up with all of this uniformity. We want to mix it up a little. And you get paid on both ends, huh?
Yes. You know, if type designers had their way, all publications, newspapers and magazines, would redesign themselves totally every couple of years because we would get a lot more business that way. In real life, that doesn't seem to happen. It was probably many decades since the New York Times comprehensively redesigned the headline style. And all being well, I should think they'll be happy with this for some time to come.
There was a time, probably about 15 or 20 years ago, when, you know, you just never heard the word typeface or font in a sentence. Yeah. But we're in a different world now. I have a Windows XP, and I got, I don't know, close to 200 typefaces, and a lot of people who were willing to engage in conversations about them. Has your world changed with the digitization of America?
It certainly has. Yeah, for most of my life, you know, if somebody insisted on knowing what I did for a living and I said I was a type designer, they wouldn't have had a clue what I was talking about. But nowadays, particularly if you use the word font, which is the term for a typeface that's become adopted for the computer, then pretty much everyone nowadays at least knows what a font is. And in some cases, they know the names of fonts.
You ever go into a bar in Cambridge and walk up to a woman and say, excuse me, Verdana, Verdana Bold, Verdana Condensed? That's mine. I did that. Can I buy you a drink?
I haven't taken exactly that approach, but one of the, you know, one of the funny incidental things that's come out of the work I did for Microsoft, which included some of these screen fonts like Verdana and Georgia, is, you know, running into people who, when they find out what I do, they say, oh, you know, we had this memo come around the office the other day. We've all got to start using this typeface called Verdana. And have you ever heard of that? And so I then modestly allow that, yes, I have. And I was responsible for the design of it. I think it still amazes people that, you know, they know fonts exist, but they, generally speaking, think they must sort of materialize out of the cyber ether in some way without any human intervention. But when they meet someone and find out that I'm involved in the creation of these things, they still find it bizarre that someone does that for a living.
Well, Matthew Carter, thank you very much. You've been a font of information. Oh, my goodness. How I amuse myself. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're most welcome. It's nice talking to you.
Matthew Carter is the typographer responsible for the recent revamping of the New York Times headline style and has probably designed most of the letters that you, good listener, read every day. Do you have a theme song?
A theme song? No, I don't. No.
Well, if you'll permit us, we're about to arbitrarily assign you one.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
This week marked the anniversary of the siege by Chechenian terrorists of the Moscow Theater, an episode that ended with the death of all of the terrorists and 129 hostages, most by anesthetic gas pumped into the theater by the Russian security services. Now, using video actually left behind by the terrorists themselves, a documentary airing on HBO presents an extraordinary view of the crisis, the unbearable agony, as 800 people sat for 57 hours waiting to die.
In a quiet moment, the gunman with the video camera focused on his leader.
That's a cut from Terror in Moscow, airing right now on HBO. Filmmaker Dan Reed says he was astonished to be given access to the terrorists' footage, but says it's still unclear why the video was made in the first place.
That's one of the puzzles. Was it to a message to their sponsors? Was it to prove to the people who'd financed the operation that they'd actually, you know, done this? Was it to have something to brag about later on if they escaped? Or was it to release to the media? We just don't know. But at any rate, one of the gunmen simply waved the camera around. He filmed the most extraordinary scenes that I've ever seen inside a terrorist operation, basically. It's shot like a home video. He's saying hi to the guys, hi to the girls. You know, people are talking very, very intimately to the camera, saying things, making jokes. It's quite surreal.
Were there any journalistic reservations in using that? Somehow ex post facto carrying out the wishes of the terrorists?
We didn't really have any reservations because the story of the siege was told really from the hostages' point of view. You know, the people giving testimony are the people who lost loved ones who were sitting next to them, you know, who never woke up after the gas was introduced. And I think that kind of counterbalances the sort of gunman vision that you get from the tape.
Coincidentally, last night I happened to see the new Quentin Tarantino film, Kill Bill Volume 1. And in it, about 75 people get killed with samurai swords. There's blood spurting out of people's bodies like water from a fire hydrant. It's so graphic that at some point the images, they just stop being disturbing.
Mm.
Now, the reason I bring this up is I've just 10 minutes ago finished watching your film. And right up to the moment I walked into this studio, I was having difficulty remaining composed. The violence is simply overwhelming. But it's mainly the violence of desperation. It's beyond desperation. It's just this endless waiting for death. It's very difficult to take.
Yeah, yeah. To make a film about people waiting to die and what's more, sitting next to their loved ones and waiting to die with their loved ones was an overwhelming emotional experience for me. And to me, this film really is about being a hostage and what people are like when they face death and they know that death is coming.
Well, I want to ask you about that because the film is just gigantically affecting. It is a monumental achievement. So I hope you won't take me as being argumentative when I ask you why. What do we gain by the exercise of sitting through and vicariously living this terror?
I think we gain two things. I mean, on the one hand, we gain an understanding of what actually happened, and that's worth something in journalistic and historical terms. On a deeper level, I think it's kind of reassuring to know that when faced with the bleakest possible situation in your life, that understanding is possible, that at the end of the day, the hostages ended up not really hating their captors. One man who was the oboist in the orchestra said to me, you know, by the end, I didn't hate the women anymore. To me, they were like the rain. They were like a storm. They were like a natural phenomenon. It was a disaster, but he'd kind of risen above recriminations and hatred.
The film is almost pointedly apolitical. It doesn't really take sides. It is, however, sympathetic, it seems to me, to one particular set of people, and that is the 19 women they called the Black Widows. Tell me about the Black Widows.
These were young women, most of whom had lost a relative or several relatives in fighting with the Russians, men taken away in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. These women all dressed in black with 5 or 6 pounds of explosives strapped around their waist. They were holding in one hand a detonator connected to wires, which would set off the bomb. And in the other hand, they usually wielded a pistol or a hand grenade. So they were very frightening figures, and they sat amongst the audience. And as a result, a lot of people had conversations with the Black Widows. And to me, that was something I was very, very curious about. It was an extraordinary length of time for people to get to know their executioners. It wasn't a case of the hostages identifying with their captors. It was simply a case that over the hours and hours of the siege, they understood that these women had basically been hoodwinked or hoodwinked themselves or were just so desperate that they seemed to have no other course of action. And naturally, they felt a degree of understanding for them.
And yielding this chilling moment at the end of the film where one of the Russian hostages considers the question for a moment and decides that had her son died, would she have done the same thing to exact revenge against the Chechens? And the answer she came up with was, yeah, she would.
Mm. She was a remarkable woman. She'd been shot in the course of the siege. She'd been taken away. Her daughter and husband stayed in the building, and they died of the gas. She had a son who she left at home, who didn't go to the theater. And she says, you know, I hate the Chechens now. I hate them. But had my son not survived, I probably would feel like strapping on a bomb and going and blowing myself up. You know, she's living for her son. And she gives us this insight into the mind of someone who's lost absolutely everyone and everything. I felt it was important to end the film on a complex note. It wasn't a case of, oh, well, everyone lived happily ever after, and here are the good guys and here are the bad guys. You know, there is a bigger issue, which is the war between Chechnya and Russia. And then there's also just a human factor, which is that, you know, I tried to, I suppose, for a second, make people think about what drove these women, the Black Widows, to come there and to show that, you know, they were human too. And if a Russian woman can think that way, well, so can a Chechen woman.
Well, Dan Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Dan Reed is director and producer of Terror in Moscow, a new documentary about last year's Moscow theater siege by Chechen separatists. It's being shown this Friday, the 31st, and again the following Monday as part of HBO's America Undercover series.
This is basically an unfair interview designed to try to trap me into saying something that Harpers can use. And you know it, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And that is the end of this interview.
Oh, so you're not even going to give me the chance to ask you a follow-up question. You have to make a speech and then have the last word? You're gone.
Bill O'Reilly, Terry Gross, the now famous walk-off interview. We had intended to hold our tongues on this subject because why pour gasoline onto the fire? But since that confrontation, Gross has been criticized by NPR's ombudsman, prompting Fox News Channel's O'Reilly to go on the air claiming final proof of NPR's leftist agenda. All right, what exactly has taken place here? Well, the first thing is, Terry Gross did an uncharacteristically ham-fisted hatchet job of an interview on Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly, welcome to Fresh Air. As you probably know, Al Franken was on the show and his book came out. Are you sorry you sued him?
I didn't sue him.
Oh, no, Fox sued him, but I assume
well,
you...
I had no,
and
no
the Inquisition proceeded. And, why Gross so departed from her famously even-handed style is a bit of a mystery. But the answer might have to do with O'Reilly's own sordid history of on-air bullying. Night after night in his no-spin zone, he twists facts, tosses Molotov cocktails, and pushes around guests for the entertainment of his Fox News Channel audience.
Hold it. Okay.
Well,
you either want
to listen or you don't.
No, well, I have other questions. That's your interpretation.
Yes,
mine is different. The audience can decide. Now, two more questions.
You, that's it. I'm not going to say any more.
Okay.
In respect for your father,
September
4th,
you want to know what I was doing?
Shut up.
He shouts guests down. He calls people names, such as Pinhead and Coward. When all else fails, he tells them to shut up. And the ugliest brand, Traitor, rolls easily off his tongue. O'Reilly has a lot of favorite targets, but one of his extra, extra, extra special favorites is NPR, which he regards as the quintessence of elitism, political correctness, and liberal bias. Let's just say that the journalistic values of skepticism, free speech, and suspicion of government overlap progressive orthodoxy enough to give that bias charge at least a whiff of truth. A whiff which O'Reilly unceasingly inflates into the big lie of a conspiratorial liberal media agenda. O'Reilly's many smaller prevarications have been amply documented elsewhere, but we have more than passing interest in one of them, his repeated claim before the Fresh Air interview that he's never been invited on an NPR show. He continued to say that long after being featured on this show, following a long interview with our Mike Pesca. That piece, unsurprisingly, caught O'Reilly in a whopper.
I'm a registered independent politically, and I'm a journalist who looks at life the way it is, not the way I want it to be.
In reality, O'Reilly is not a registered independent. He's been a registered Republican since 1994. When this information came to light after our original interview, O'Reilly said he made a mistake when registering to vote in Nassau County, Long Island, 6 years ago. But records show that he's voted in at least five elections since then, each time being confronted with his party registration, which he never took any steps to change.
That followed by the subsequent lie that he had never met Mike Pesca in his life. And so on. O'Reilly has repeatedly declined a return visit, but if I were face-to-face with him, it would be hard for me to resist what Gross could not resist. Not because of his conservative politics. We've long since excoriated Michael Moore, for instance, for his unfair tactics on behalf of the far left. But because O'Reilly is such a disgrace, such a mockery of Fox News Channel's claim to fairness and balance. So, yes, Terry Gross lost her cool and played right into Bill O'Reilly's hands by failing to let judgment override her contempt. It was egg on her face and on NPR's. I only wish it could have been egg on mine, because to take a crack at this bellicose Humpty Dumpty, I'd happily wear an entire omelet. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Our managing editor is Brooke Gladstone. Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. Brooke will be back with me next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.